Welcome to the Alternative Data Podcast. Welcome to the Alternative Data Podcast, powered by CFM. I'm Mark Fleming Williams. In this episode, I speak to Don D'Amico, formerly of New Data, and now the CEO and founder of Glacier Network, a new company that helps companies manage the legal considerations in their data chain. In our conversation, we track the evolving alternative data regulation discussion and talk about the kinds of pitfalls that can blow up a data provider or can hurt a data buyer who has not written their contract with enough care. Separately, I'm in Singapore for Battlefin next week, so if you are in that direction and want to talk about an interesting dataset, please do get in touch. So in this episode, I'm joined by Don D'Amico of Glacier Network. Thanks for joining today, Don.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me. I'm a long-time listener, first-time caller.
Fantastic. So, Don, I've been aware of you for a long time. I'm sure many listeners will be. You were previously managing director and general counsel at New Data. You were their kind of legal head. And you left there in June 2023 to set up the Glacier Network. So this is a really good opportunity to talk to somebody who spent a lot of time thinking about the regulatory and legal side of alternative data. Looking forward to diving into that. I think as is traditional, where I'm generally interested is when does alternative data come across your bows?
Yeah, so I mean, I think without going into the whole sort of like what is it and what constitutes alt data, I think, you know, sometime around 2015, I worked at a large hedge fund, and you know, hedge funds at that time were starting, if you look at like the top 20 by AUM or something like that, they were generally starting to have these small portfolios of what we call alt data. And it was around that time when, big credit card data sets were, you know, making the cover of the Wall Street Journal. And, of course, there have been several firms before that, you know, even as early as 2009 or so that were looking at this stuff. But it's been an almost decade long now journey. And I was certainly not setting out to become involved in alternative data. It was really kind of an accident. I just happened to notice that of the different kinds of technology things that I was working on at a hedge fund, the data stuff tended to be more interesting and more complex.
And fresher and newer in a way. It's something to really dig your teeth into. And anyone can see by looking at your LinkedIn, you're at Davidson Kempner.
That's right. I'm still very hesitant to name hedge funds. It's been beaten into me over over time.
I'm sure they appreciate it. And so you were kind of presumably doing kind of DDQs and things like that at that point, and advising on the emerging issues. What were the emerging issues around alternative data in 2015 to 2018? What was the conversation about?
Yeah, you know, it was very interesting because hedge funds came up with this rubric. They sort of self-regulated in a sense, you know, and you really have to, people rarely give hedge funds credit for these kind of ethical things that they're doing. In fact, they tend to assume that there's this kind of, you know, amoral activity around trading. But hedge funds went out and said, we're going to invest a tremendous amount of time and resource with law firms, industry groups to create a framework for taking in, you know, what I'm starting to call other people's data, which is just my own little joke with myself. But for taking in external data or alternative data, and it didn't exist at the time, not really. People were, at that time, law firms were sort of generally aware, there were a handful in New York that were aware of the more obvious securities law issues around, insider trading and potential material non-public information risk. And, you know, what is public information and all these questions. It was around the time when I think Netflix had published comments on Facebook, and it was raising all these interesting issues. But it was also a time when major categories of alternative data were yet to be widely consumed by the fund industry. Like web scraping was very much kind of the darker shade of gray issue back then. And I think people, you know, I watched real time.
Was it seen as dangerous?
Yeah, I think people were just sort of like, what is this? Why are, you know, it was new. And anything new, you know, especially if you are a large hedge fund, you kind of want the world order to be the way it is because you've sort of already won the game. And new things can be scary. And then I think that that was, you know, that made it also very attractive to work on.
When you say hedge funds are very good at reaching out and creating a framework, was this via the FISD or were they doing it directly?
Yeah, so there were, you know, funds, the larger funds tend to engage many New York law firms. And so there were a handful of law firms that jumped on the issue early that have now, you know, those are sort of the well-known names, those partners. FISD has been involved for a long time. It's grown enormously over the past 5 years. It was a really small group. But, you know, there were these data breakfasts and other kinds of events that, you know, I've been attending, and they're, you know, all of the other sort of boldface names that go to these conferences were kind of just forming back then.
Are they kind of so? I mean, this is a side of the community that I've seen it because I've logged into the kind of the FISD Alt Data Council thing, and I see all the legal counsels all rattling away at each other at the from all the funds. So I see that conversation happening. Is there a whole kind of shadow community of you know? Because obviously I see, and I don't want to say shadow. Maybe the kind of new data events, they're the shadow, and actually the light version of the legal part. But is there kind of are there legal alternative data events where the councils get together? Is that happening?
Yes, there certainly are. There are some great ones. You know, my friend Kelly at Schulte runs them with Tracy at FISD. There's a lot of very, you know, there's a lot of super sophisticated practitioners that meet fairly regularly to discuss, you know, the more major like topical issues. I would say they're, you know, like any other thing, these conversations, yes, not only are they going on, they're going on all the way to the level of sort of shadow conversations where there's, you know, kind of the text chain on my phone. And it's surprising how active and sort of, you know, well connected these people are becoming to one another. So there's very much a vibrant community of people who are just thinking about things like web scraping all day long. So
Yeah. Okay. I don't think we are going to talk through your career, actually. I usually do, but I don't think we are. I think we are going to say how let's talk it through from a kind of legal alternative data perspective. So how would you describe the way the legal conversation around alternative data has developed during the time that you have been in it?
Yeah, I think it's gone from being this sort of like, you know, kind of a sort of like a murky and sort of uncomfortable area for funds to go into, and to being something that, given the framework that people have put so much time into creating, and given that there are some norms now, you know, like very specific sort of ordinary seeming things, you know, you diligence your counterparty, you might do a phone call, you might collect a due diligence questionnaire that might be in several formats that are designed to go deeper and broader depending on what you hear back each time. You memorialize responses in internal memos, you save a file, your records are easily retrievable quickly and consistent and follow a consistent policy that's in writing.
But
Boom, there
everyone
you go,
knows
Mark.
that.
I'm just
But
that's yeah,
everyone,
that
everyone,
didn't exist. That
but
didn't
everyone.
exist 10 years ago.
Yeah, I suppose that's what I was going to say. Everyone knows that now. So back then, it was kind of like, so everyone was
It
kind
was
of
very ad hoc.
going off their own direction and kind of saying, "Well, I'm doing this. Maybe the SEC will like that," and then somebody else is doing something else. And so gradually, I suppose the guidance has been kind of handed down from the mountain from the SEC a little bit more and drips and drabs, and so there's been more standardization. What about the topics? So you mentioned web scraping. Have there always been the same kind of flashpoint topics that everyone's been discussing, and it's all been developing along various kind of the same tracks?
You've always had a few pillars to this conversation where, you know, the number one pillar is for this industry, for the financial services industry, just sort of has to be insider trading because it's really the one that can put you in prison. And that tends to be something that people are more terrified of than monetary damages. But you've got insider trading, privacy, intellectual property. the web scraping issues, the CFAA. It has been these kind of consistent pillars over time, but this is where it gets interesting because the legal framework has to be able to breathe and expand to meet technology. And that's why it's always going to be a little bit different. The answer is always going to be, it depends. And there's always something new. You know, of course, right now, everyone is scrambling to understand how new is AI? What is, you know, what is the impact? What does it include? What do I have to do to respond to it? And it's very interesting because it's a little bit like deja vu all over again with the kind of like, well, what is this new thing? You know, alt data. And with AI, you know, there really are, there's quite a lot of framework already in place that has applied to software and automated data collection and things like that for quite a long time. So it's interesting to try to separate, you know, what are the meaningful issues from a fund's perspective and a data company's perspective versus, you know, what is already covered by things like copyright and all of this. But that's a very interesting conversation that's just started.
I'd love to see an anatomy of that conversation, you know, and that kind of, you know, early adopters and then the laggards at the end. Like, who is the, when something like AI happens, who's the first person? Where, how did the conversation begin? Who's beginning the conversation, do you think?
You mean inside of a fund that wants to use the technology, or do you mean sort of,
is that
community?
Where it begins? So it's definitely not the regulator that starts talking first. The regulator is always slow to the game. So the first person is OpenAI gets released. It was a big bang, wasn't it, when it landed, and everyone was just talking about it on LinkedIn. You know, this thing is, oh my God, it's exciting. So at that point, essentially, the head of legal at every hedge fund is going, we need to start thinking about this. That's they're the first ones who are going to start thinking about shape that, thinking about starting talking about it, which begins that conversation. Is that?
Yeah, I mean, I think AI is a little bit unique in that it has the theoretical possibility to be the single biggest and most defining issue of these businesses will face. You know, it's an extinction level event, or potentially sort of the opposite, where they can kind of permanently distance themselves from their peers and sort of dominate a market. I think that what was very interesting about AI over the past year is that it is something where I think general counsels, you know, general counsels of these funds are very sophisticated practitioners. They actually went out proactively in a lot of cases and into their community and said, what should we all be doing? Let's think about this before the business comes to us. Where I would say normally, you know, in my experience as an in-house counsel, many of these issues kind of roll downhill. Like, you know, the head of data or the portfolio manager will say, we need to get on top of this. This is a competitive issue and I'm interested in this. And then it goes to the legal people who try to solve for risk. But I think with AI, it's just so enormous that people are once again going out proactively and saying, like, you know, they're sort of, the legal people are trying to build up a reasonable framework, even probably much faster than their firms are actually doing anything very sophisticated with AI. And the government has, you know, really, like, this is another thing where it's so big that the government is also going out on its own. I say the government, I mean everyone from the SEC to the White House. And, you know, the White House had a very unusual rule that it's already promulgated that if you have a certain level of compute power, you have to start reporting to us. I don't know that anyone is actually doing that, but it's very noteworthy and unusual to see a number in a regulatory prescription like that.
Do you think that's kind of a monopoly of violence type thing? It's a little bit like a private army. If you got that much compute power, I wonder if you could be a threat to somebody.
Well, what's scary for us, I think, is that, you know, hedge funds tend to have this, you know, they're not interested in any of the issues that the other, you know, that the rest of the world is worried about. You know, they're just trying to make sophisticated investment decisions. But a very well-resourced and large fund could inadvertently develop something that is so sophisticated with AI that it kind of, you know, sort of like it kind of gives birth to some kind of monster that then, you know, that the fund is not properly incentivized to contain. And what's that's the fear.
What's the book about AI by Max Tegmark? And he imagines essentially that somebody breaks through and creates the
AGI.
AGI. Yeah. And but the trick will be like, what do you do with it? And so they use it. The first thing you need to do is create money, essentially. And so they use it. They get this AGI to solve jobs on Fiverr and other websites like that, online, and build up a fund of money like that. But once the idea being, once you've got an AGI, then you can do anything, essentially. You're that much more efficient than the rest of the market, that you can, then it's lots of easy ways to kind of just do minor, sweep the money in, and then the power and the rest.
Right. And then, you know, it's exactly all the things that are addressed. If you've ever played the paperclip game, you can download the app. And one of the things that happens early on is you actually inadvertently build a hedge fund, because it's just faster for all of your other activities to have infinite money. But you know, I think that's why, to pull this in back into all data, like, that's why it's so important for us to be working on these risk and regulatory issues in alt data now, because alt data is a piece of the puzzle with AI and cybersecurity, which have become kind of the dominant, you know, national security issues. And they impact so many things, from not just daily life of kind of, you know, like who's surveilling you to sell you a different candy bar or something, you know, the very mundane, but all the way up to what are our, you know, adversaries and other nation states doing to try to disrupt our way of life. And I think if the U.S. can become much smarter about the different ways that they can use alternative data ethically and legally, we can maintain sort of an ethical strength in our position and how we use, you know, data in the government as well. And, you know, Glacier, you know, one of my goals now is to do that knowledge transfer, you know, this framework that the hedge funds know, and all these interesting sort of ways to use data that they know that are responsible, you know, to transfer those to other organizations. And
this is what I was about to get into. So I came across you when you were working at NuData. You'd set up the Sentry program, which, or were instrumental in setting up the Sentry program, which was a kind of maybe you can describe it better than me, but and now since June 2023, you've created Glacier. But could you, I mean, maybe first of all say what you're doing in NuData, and then maybe say what the vision of Glacier is?
Yeah, I think you know, the NuData Sentry product was addressing, like, you know, just a major headache for so many of these funds around document collection and updating diligence information and reaching out to large numbers of vendors. And it's just like it's a very time-saving thing to have a platform step in and aggregate and collect all of those things and maintain them. You know, it also offered, because they have a platform, you can take that content and link it to other features in the platform that are oriented towards sourcing. So I think that solved a lot of problems for really a wide range of financial services firms on the compliance side. What I'm focused on now is this concept that everyone, you know, at least with financial services, every organization has what I would call a data supply chain. And it's just sort of, regardless of whether you label these things risk and compliance or business issues, you need your supply chain to be clean, strong, functional, and basically ever expanding. And you can't do that if you have problems, if people don't trust what's coming in, if things are breaking, if you're not watching them. And so that's what we've started doing for funds. But it's very different. You know, I'm not collecting, aggregating content in one place with the goal of building kind of, you know, the walled garden, and then having this platform be something that people have to come to. These days I'm more thinking about integration with other people's platforms, pushing information to them rather than collecting it. And, you know, we don't have a particular goal of kind of, you know, 15x revenue sale of a platform or something like that.
You're not a repository, you're more of an alert system.
Yeah, it's something like that. You know, I wouldn't de-emphasize the human element, but I would say that you know, there are other people now working on this concept of like data rooms, basically, where you subscribe and you go in and you can just download documents. that's much more on the human end of things than what I'm doing. I think eventually we will, you know, be more sort of API driven and just kind of faster.
And so a customer subscribes to Glacier. I saw you just set up with your initial bunch of subscribers. So, And so what are they, how will it work? What are they going to expect from you?
Yeah, they're getting what we call threat reporting on problems with, that, you know, that are impacting these data companies, and they get them very frequently. And my research into those companies is constant. So it's just a different, I think this grew out of the regulatory requirement that you actually be doing that if you're a regulated buyer. But it has a number of other applications once you start doing it. You know, you're learning about these products more frequently. And then, you know, for example, a front office person can say, oh, I didn't realize that there was this problem. Maybe we should look at an alternative. What are the alternatives? All of those kinds of things are now happening. And, you know, a good example, just a freebie for the audience, anyone who's listening now, there's this problem with CoStar and STR that is, I think litigation is an extremely well-known, widely understood threat to a data vendor. But STR and CoStar now have this enormous antitrust case where the evidence looks terrible in terms of the story that's being told and what's alleged about their conduct. And that can very well, those kind of issues could potentially, in some cases, turn into an existential threat for a company where a product is either no longer available or, I guess more commonly, just the data is degraded because so many of the sources are ripped out. And that's one that many sophisticated funds are watching closely right now. But that's just an example of the kind of thing that can happen on any given Wednesday. You know, it's just sort of, that's the world you live in as your portfolio grows.
Let's have a more solid example, which everybody is probably aware of, which was Bright Data and Facebook have been in legal wrangles, suing each other for a number of years, and there was a judgment recently which seemed to be positive for Bright Data. But before this recent judgment, if Bright Data was your supplier, and this case, this risk was ongoing, it was happening, how should you cope with that risk?
Yeah, I mean, look, anyone who's really sharp about web scraping is keeping a written log with information about what they're scraping, what's been approved, how they're using it, you know, what specific pages, when it was last assessed, all of that stuff. And so the Meta case with Bright Data was, you know, the alt data industry, which is very niche, but it hailed that as yet another massive positive milestone. Web scraping is legal, et cetera. It was in many ways just a garden variety contract interpretation case that could have been decided that way years ago and didn't really reveal anything new. You know, you're reading terms and conditions and what do they say, and the court interprets them, right? I thought there were some very interesting aspects of the interpretation that were quite favorable to the scraping company, were sort of like garden variety contract terms, like, you know, does this thing survive? Does it matter that, you know, that literally the interpretation will be this? Many of those points were all decided very favorably for the web scraping company. And I think that, you know, that's the particular court in the Ninth Circuit, or sorry, the district court in California that has also seen the HiQ case. They're very familiar with these issues. But yeah, so it's sort of like, I think we're going to continue to have these cases where something positive happens for scraping and everyone says, is it legal now? It's always a matter of the particulars of the site and the content being taken out and all of this stuff. So I think the answer is, you know, often it is legal. It's a little bit better than it depends, but
it's still an ambiguous judgment. But what I was getting at more, because you're providing a service which is keeping customers up to date with this stuff and warning, yes, and reporting and letting them know. So my question more is, what do I do with your information?
Yeah. So the first point is you just have to have this, because collecting it is just something that you need to do as a regulated buyer.
Ignorance is a negative in the eyes of the SEC.
Yeah, you can no longer just sort of bury your head in the sand and sort of say, oh, I was totally unaware that scraping. But anyway, yeah, so the first point is just you address a regulatory obligation, and that's a pain point for many people. The second thing would be, okay, saying, similar, I think a very common use case already that's cropped up is what is the read across to similar vendors? What other, in this very narrow example, what other sites have similar terms to Meta's terms or Instagram's terms? And the sites that don't, what is their cadence for changing those terms? And when should we expect to get hit with a $5 million API charge in order to continue getting what we're getting on sentiment or whatever else it is? And then if you knock out something like Instagram, many other things downstream will kind of wither or die. So it's managing all of that. And I imagine someone in your position, Mark, like you've worked with many data sources, you can sort of see that a lot of these things are connected. So that's a good example, I guess, is just this kind of read across and saying if this happens, then these other things are likely to happen. So you should prepare yourself in these ways, like months in advance.
Are you telling me these things, or are you telling me what's going on with the Bright Data court case, and I need to make those other inferences myself, or are you telling me all those other things around, that this is what it means for web scraping? So I'd recommend that perhaps you should have a look at your other web scrapers
Yeah,
because.
we certainly editorialize and we do it very succinctly, but I think that that's a lot of the value that people pay for is to sort of say, like, okay, if this thing happens to STR, CoStar, Bright Data, who's next? What do I need to do to sort of reorient myself to kind of get the same value? Or like, how much collateral damage should I expect to my models and all these other things? Could be just, a short sentence, but that's. That we go well beyond kind of thinking about like just putting a thing in front of you and summarizing it. We try to give very industry specific suggestions about how to respond.
You mentioned that from a hedge fund perspective, the biggest fear is insider trading. Is that because the punishments are the potential punishments are the highest for that?
It's the only issue that doesn't turn into a cost of doing business, unfortunately. The extremely cynical way to describe it. Everything else you can just sort of so like a company like Meta, they pay enormous fines, and yet they continue to make huge revenue, so it sort of balances out for them. Privacy issues tend to turn into these fines as well, and there haven't been really these actions against the buyers as much. And so, yeah, insider trading is going to be the thing that keeps us up at night.
Okay. From a data provider's perspective, or looking at data providers, what do you see as the biggest, and I think always, well, I don't know whether I want to do this from the perspective of a buyer or the provider themselves, but what do you see as the biggest risk for data providers from this perspective?
Well,
What are
the
they
truth.
most at risk of getting done for?
Yeah, I mean, I think their biggest risk is going to be that they collect something that they don't have, that is clearly they're not permitted to provide to other people. Maybe not even a gray area, but just sort of like they're just outright don't have the rights to do something. That will kill their product faster than anything. I think a sort of secondary or subset of this is the fact that often many providers are licensing something from some other source upstream, and the upstream source, this is actually a true thing about the industry. The average is probably about 5 years or less on the upstream license. And if that license expires, I've seen real cases where unfortunately the data proves to be valuable, the license expires, and then the data company wants to keep collecting and providing its product to the funds. It can't get a renewal because it can't afford. It's basically like, its landlord is kicking it out of its apartment kind of thing. And that's a very practical risk that many people don't think about when they're starting these data companies because it just seems so far out.
And if, as you say, there's a 5-year license, and a year before the end of that license, a buy side signs a contract with the downstream
That's really bad
provider,
then. Yeah.
a 3-year contract, then what happens?
You're probably, you may be looking at a material breach of the contract and then the mechanics under the contract and the law about, how do we terminate, what are the remedies? Do we get a refund or not? And that's actually, it's a good point that many people, I always try to remind people that are looking at their data contracts, like if you lose your data product, you need to get a refund, and the refund needs to have rules that are written down about when it happens, who's actually obligated to pay you, all of that good stuff, because it gets glossed over very often. And I think that, these very unglamorous issues are actually kind of what drive the day-to-day. You just have to be careful about that.
In any of your seats, apart from the one where you were at Davidson Kempner, do you get an eyeball into when these things go wrong?
Yes.
Do you hear about it? You see it?
Yes. And I also have perspective on, what is it, How do different types of buyers react differently to these issues, and like how do they document them and things like that, having worked at a law firm where you see many of these clients. I guess sometimes I think that it turns into a lot of hot air and there's a lot of angry phone calls, and then people just sort of go on with their lives. The truth is, these problems rarely does either side want to litigate, the buyer or the seller of data. They don't want to be in court. They don't want public attention to any of this stuff. It's embarrassing. It's time consuming. It's expensive. It's bad. So it is important to have these contracts done in a way where the two sides can sort of sit down reasonably and interpret things that are somewhat clear. And often it comes down to kind of a like, let's split things down the middle and just sort of negotiate informally.
Do you think you've got enough examples in your head to be able to say what the most common pitfalls in contracts with alternative data providers turn out to be? Where is there a heat map around the, this is the most likely place that it's going to go wrong?
Yeah, there's a few. I hate to like burn the provider side of the market because, they go for it.
Yeah,
but yes. Okay, let's do it. So a lot of the times these contracts, like where you're getting an expensive data product, could even be six figures or more, don't actually say anything about what the product is. So if I had to invent one, I would just say like, you're going to get all this amazing transactional data that we call edge data or something. And then I don't say anything to you about the frequency, the cell, the formatting of the data, the file type, the size, the speed, the reporting period, the history, all of that stuff, right? All of the things that someone like you, Mark, would think about if you were actually assessing the business case are not part of the actual deal. So that is maybe one of the number one most common things that people are just infuriated by, and they don't realize when they buy these expensive data products. And so, a trick there that some funds will do now is they'll attach a schedule. They will create some kind of, they'll say that these marketing materials are part of the deal and all of that stuff. But it's very important to look at those data dictionaries and those other sort of product characteristics and bake them in. I would say the other things that come up all the time also. Very
have you ever, on that one, first of all.
Yeah.
You've seen examples where the providers have been able to say, look, man, I just said I'd give you edge. Here is a box that I just called edge,
Yep.
And they've actually...
Happens all the time.
They've had that as their defense, essentially.
Absolutely.
We define what edge is, and this is edge, by the way, now.
Yep, that's quite common. It's more it's shockingly common. I think it's less and less now that this industry is evolving. But, particularly where a product is very new or very attractive, there's sort of like the supply side of the market can just do that.
How big a worry do you think, and it probably depends from provider to provider, but how big a worry in such a situation would you see reputational risk as being? We don't want to be, yes, contractually we can do that, but we've still got to do business tomorrow. And, what if it got out or whatever?
It's a very wise thing for, the founders of these companies are often very sophisticated, kind of like, they're good at lots of different things. And I think they understand that a deal with a fund is two parts. It's a legal part, and it's sort of the human and business element, which includes trust. And no deal works without both of those things. And you're right. So I think they're desperately trying to provide the best product, the best experience. These things, the other point is obviously that, you know, very few of these data companies get to the point where they have a fixed legal resource that can look at these issues, right? They are trying to keep the lights on for long periods of time until they get to, you know, 5 years in or whatever. And they may do these things inadvertently, where a very interesting problem is that the buyer has sophisticated counsel and resources. The buyer is often rewriting these documents and telling the providers, you know, from a business perspective too, telling the provider, this is what your data needs to do to be better. You need to change it in this way. And the data scientist at a fund may actually sort of rebuild parts of a product for them, as you probably well know.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And so what's the next of the pitfalls? If you hadn't, I stopped you as you were going on to another one.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other, so there's, you know, what if the provider just is giving you something that they shouldn't be giving you, but that's a little more uncommon and abstract. I think the mundane stuff, like you didn't tell me that this thing was renewing and you've sent me an invoice.
Yeah.
That really, you know, that, I mean, I'm sure, Mark, I'm probably like preaching to the choir, but you know, really bothers people.
I'm just a podcast host, honestly. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yes. But you know, that kind of stuff. And then the gamesmanship around sort of being not transparent about these renewal mechanisms. I think that, you know, that's just not good practice.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And that's the same in any business, isn't it? I mean, sure. A lot of it comes back to that reputational question, but when the sums get big enough, then, you know, you can't. So, you know, that's when we go to court, I suppose. And so also we have seen we've seen data providers disappear.
Sure.
And that's a risk from a buy side perspective. Obviously it's a risk from a data provider's perspective, but from the buy side perspective, it's a risk. What do you think, looking at the ways that data providers have kind of exploded, what can we learn from that in terms of trying not to buy data from potentially data providers that might disappear? How have they gone wrong?
Yeah, you know, unfortunately I do think there's a little bit of a common strain. So obviously they're like any other business, they can have a basic garden variety business problem, just not enough funding, run out of runway,
bad data,
licenses expire, all of that stuff, right? But I think, unfortunately, there is a bit of a common strain, because a lot of them tend to be startups, is that you have founder and management risk. And, you know, I think, unfortunately, if you looked at some of the real cases that have come up, or cases where particular vendors, even larger ones, have had problems, it's been because of, you know, what look like poor decisions or sort of failure to govern correctly. And I think you could get at that stuff. You can always write whatever you want in a contract. I think you could get at that stuff by, you want to have, you know, you want to assess these people that are running these companies as well, and watch them, watch their behavior, talk to them, get a sense of how seriously do they take their obligations to do what they say they're doing with respect to data collection and governance and all of that. And I think it's just really hard to detect, but, you know, probably sometimes there are yellow flags, or even just kind of being street smart about who's sitting on the other side of the table could probably save you headaches later.
Yeah. So look them in the eye. At the end of the day, we're humans, and trying to judge whether you trust the guy or not is a good,
right.
good basis. Exclusivity is always a fun topic. Is it happening? MMPI? Or how does it get past MMPI? Is it in the market if it only belongs to one person? Have you heard of any examples of the ways it's working, if it's happening? What can you talk around the subject?
Yeah, I mean, so some of this is I mean, it's really anecdotal, and like I talk to lots of people, and my impressions and things. So, yes, I think people are out there getting exclusive deals. I think it would be naive to think that they're not, to think they're pursuing this. There, people are trying to get. I think still, decade plus into this industry growing, like people are still looking to be the first. To have the only access to a new data set to look for alpha. They believe that the alpha goes away once other people come in. I dispute some of that because I think a lot of it is about combinations of many data sets plus human ingenuity now. And that's actually their defense in part to the idea that any of this is could be material non-public information that could raise insider trading liabilities. It takes a lot of human creativity and intelligence and thought and more than just the information. Obviously, if this investment process were as simple as just, you have the answer, we wouldn't need teams of analysts to do it. But I kind of react negatively to the idea of going out and looking to be, the only person getting a credit card data set or something like that, because it does raise this concern that if the market is too small, if access is too constrained, if the price is too high, it looks awfully a lot like, there's some kind of impropriety
That
in
last
being
one
the only
is,
one that has it.
that last one's a funny one though, isn't it? If the price is too high, I mean,
Yeah,
if
I don't think that in isolation sort of means that something is a problematic data
I
set,
mean,
right?
if somebody is paying however many X million for this thing and no one else wants to, then that's in the market, isn't it? It's just the market is very highly priced. It's like the market for Leonardo da Vinci's. I can't because I can't afford it, but I'm quite happy that somebody else is. It's
Yeah, well, there, what confounds people is that this is kind of like a legal term of art, the concept of what is each of these terms, material, non-public. They have complicated case law analysis that's required to go through to figure out how do they apply, and they're applied by humans. But I do think, it could obviously be the case that it simply costs $5 million a year per client to provide something with a respectable margin. If it's like very complex data that's sourced from very, wealthy counterparties like banks and things like that who have no other incentive to be in this game otherwise. But it does shrink the market. There are very large funds where people working at them would tell you, we're just not going to spend $2 million a year to get this product, even though they have enormous resources. So a
which is
multi-million dollar
fine, but
product,
that but that's kind of what I'm saying is that it's a choice. That for something I don't know, and I'm just a lowly podcast host, as I say, but when to my mind, if a thing is on the market at a ridiculous price and somebody is willing to pay that ridiculous price, then it's not off market.
Yeah, that's just actually, it's interesting that you say that, Mark, because of where you are geographically. That's actually essentially the FCA position, is that these commercial products, as long as people can go out and buy them and you're not, sort of secretly only dealing with, one or two people, that those are available in the market. And then that goes a long way to mitigating these insider trading type risks. I don't know that we can think the same way in the US quite as simply. Like, I do
Interesting.
think that price, just makes it much more likely to be, too narrowly consumed.
I've got to say, it's not going to sound good to the American ear, but it sounds like socialism to me, honestly, that
Well,
everyone should have fair access at their price point to whatever
do.
good.
You have to give us this, Mark, that the world seems to be pretty pleased relatively with how our exchanges and markets work versus the rest of the world. I think we can say that.
You've just got a big landmass with access to two oceans and a great navy. Honestly, the rest has come out of that, I'm afraid.
That's
But
probably true. I won't claim any credit for any.
anyway, so brilliant. So Don, you've launched Glacier. As I say, you've got your kickoff clients. What's the so you're up and running, so you want more clients, essentially. Anyone listening to this who would like to receive the service as they understand it from what we've discussed, should get in touch. I mean, is there anything else?
Yeah, what's the Madonna answer, Mark? I want to take over the world. The idea is at this point that we'll do is, you know, eventually the longer term project is wider, broader knowledge transfer out of financial services knowledge to other kinds of organizations. You know, in particular, we're working with government now. I think these are the kinds of steps that we have to take in the alt data industry to really get to the next level of things that people have been clamoring for a long time, standards, all of that. But I think the standards, what they're going to do for us, the really bigger mission, is increase the speed at which we can transact and share. And then that feeds into all of those other, you know, kind of big picture world type missions that we've been talking about. And so, yes, the humble beginnings are providing these memberships to different kinds of companies, in particular financial services now. And so we're obviously happy to talk to any people who sort of for whom this resonates.
Your customers are where does your potential customer base stop? Is it all buy side?
It's everyone. I think every organization needs to have the functionality that we've talked about the data supply chain control. I think whether you're selling chocolate chip cookies or LP interests or running the government, you should be able to do what I'm describing, and that's why I'm so all in on it. I think it's just a universal problem.
Okay. Fantastic. Well, Don, thank you very much indeed. Very interesting conversation, and best of luck with it.
Thanks, Mark. Appreciate it.